Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Okay, Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 17, Text 21. Yam Ahurasya Stiti Janma Samyamam Tribhir Vihinam Yamanantam Rishayaha Naveda Siddharatam Iva Kvarchit Stitam Bhumandalam Murdha Sahasradamasu Yamahura. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Lord Shiva continued, all the great sages accept the Lord as the source of creation, maintenance, and destruction, although He actually has nothing to do with these activities. Therefore, the Lord is called unlimited. Although the Lord in His incarnation as Shesha holds all the universes on His hoods, each universe feels no heavier than a mustard seed to Him. Therefore, what person desiring perfection will not worship the Lord? Purport. The incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, known as Shesha or Ananta, has unlimited strength, fame, wealth, knowledge, beauty, and renunciation. As described in this verse, Ananta's strength is so great that the innumerable universes rest on his hoods. He has the bodily features of a snake with thousands of hoods. And since his strength is unlimited, all the universes resting on his hoods feel no heavier than mustard seeds. We can just imagine how insignificant a mustard seed is on the hood of a serpent. In this connection, the reader is referred to Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adi Lila, Chapter 5, verses 117 to 125. There it is stated that Lord Vishnu's incarnation as the serpentine Anantashesha, Naga, supports all the universes on his hoods. By our calculation, a universe may be very, very heavy, but because the Lord is Ananta, unlimited, He feels the weight to be no heavier than a mustard seed. Quite an awesome understanding of the workings of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Generally, we find that in most other religions of the world, the conception of God is limited to His activities within one universe. This one. The perception is limited by this immediate environment of this one planet and a few stars, a few millions of stars in the sky, a moon and a sun. And the conception of God is related to what we perceive. And there's very little description of the activities of the Supreme Lord beyond this material universe. The conception of the Lord having His own abode in the spiritual sky, Vaikuntha Loka, Krishna Loka, having different unlimited pastimes, vast varieties of unlimited devotees. And just even this activity of the creation and of not just one universe, but millions and billions of universes, and that also being something that He's not directly involved with. In other words, it's just going on as a periphery activity to His real activities. This conception you can't find anywhere except in the Bhagavatam. The vision that's painted there is a way above and beyond what any other spiritual process that we see can present to us. So the Bhagavatam is very unique in that respect. Srila Prabhupada made that point, that in the Srimad Bhagavatam, you can find things which you cannot find anywhere else, and that's its unique contribution. He gave the comparison between, you know, a pocket dictionary and the complete unabridged version. So you have both the same, in one sense, the dictionaries, and you get some description of a few words in a pocket dictionary. But in the big version, then you get everything. So there's something in the Bible, there's something in the Quran, there's something in the Talmud, is it? Jewish, like that. There's some descriptions of the Supreme Lord as being almighty and awe-inspiring, etc. But we don't get the kind of complete understanding of the Supreme Lord in his three phases as, you know, Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan that we get in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Actually, on this point about the universes, I remember I was with Prabhupada in Hyderabad. This was in August of 1976 when he was there for the opening of the temple. It was Janmashtami, and then we had Vyasa Puja there the next day. So Prabhupada liked pomegranates. Yeah, you know what a pomegranate is, yeah? What's the Hindi word? Anad. Anad. Yeah, it's pomegranate. So Prabhupada liked pomegranates. And in the afternoons, after he had taken rest, after his lunch, he would have about an hour's rest. Then when he got up, then the first thing that we would do was give him a fresh flower garland and usually a cup of fruit juice and or a whole fruit. So at this particular time, there were some very nice pomegranates that were available. So I was giving him a pomegranate in the afternoon. And I came in a few minutes later. Prabhupada rang the bell, and then he had eaten some of it, and then he told me to take the rest away. But just as I was going to take it, then he pointed to the pomegranate and all the seeds packed up inside. And he said, just like this, all the universes are packed up in the causal ocean. So whenever I see a pomegranate now, I always think about all the universes. But the point is that there are many, many universes. There's not just this one small universe. This one small universe is very insignificant compared to the creation, total creation of the Lord. And the scientists, of course, they try to create, you know, their version of the cause of everything and how things are being maintained and their ideas about the annihilation. Yeah, these things are described here, the beginning and the maintenance and the end of this universe, or many universes. Lord Shiva is giving his description. Then the material scientists are also trying to give their description. But what will they describe? They have such limited vision, just like in the previous verse. It's describing about when people see the Lord, they misunderstand him because they don't actually have a proper appreciation of who he is. And so they can't approach him. But the devotees, they're able to approach the Lord and appreciate all of his unlimited attributes and activities and characteristics very easily. And for them, no aspect of the Lord is terrible. Just that description's there about the Nagapatnis. They saw Krishna dancing on the hoods of their husband, but they were a little bit cautious about coming forward. They appreciated Krishna's prowess, but they couldn't really fully understand him and appreciate him, and therefore they were a bit cautious about coming forward. But we see where Prahlad Maharaj, he saw Lord Nisringadeva appear, burst out from the column in this ferocious form with unlimited arms and covering the whole sky and everything that you could perceive and ripping apart all the forces of Hiranyakashipu, who would terrorize the entire universe, and then taking his father and tearing him to bits on his lap. But Prahlad Maharaj had no problem coming forward and offering his respects and obeisances to Lord Nrisimhadev. Nobody else could go forward. All the demigods were there. Shiva was there, Brahma was there, even Lakshmi, who was always with the Lord. She was also afraid to go forward because of this terrifying form of Lord Narayan that they'd not seen before. But Prahlad Maharaj, he was able to easily approach him. He wasn't in the least bit perturbed, you know, by the Lord's staring eyes and his huge teeth and his flowing mane and his claws and the fact that he was garlanded with the intestines of his own father. It didn't disturb him at all because he had such a deep appreciation and affection for the Lord. So he could easily appreciate. This is just another feature of the same personality of Godhead that I love with all my heart and soul. So no problem. So this is the position of the devotees. As the devotee, as a person becomes more devoted, then all the features of Krishna become revealed to him one after another. And on the one hand, although they're very amazing to contemplate, you know, we can't, there's no way that we can appreciate how Krishna creates and maintains and destroys all the universes. You know, it can be written in a verse or in many verses. But how will we ever perceive that? You know, our perceptions of things is so limited. We have so... We're covered over and compressed, if you like, into this one little tiny situation that we're in. We're living in this little three-dimensional world here on this planet Earth. And even to know what's going on just nearby on the next planet, we have no idea. We have no clue. You know, we don't know what's going on the moon planet or, you know, the many stars that are in the sky. It's simply everybody's speculating, but nobody really knows. They say they go into outer space, but all they do really is just go up a certain distance, a few miles, and then, you know, go around in a few circles and then come back down again. There's no ability to understand anything that's going on in this universe. And even on this planet, we have no idea what's going on. You know, people, they go across the ocean, but what's at the bottom of the ocean? That people, the scientists have no understanding whatsoever. It's so deep, and there's so many different creatures down there that have never been seen. All the time they're just discovering new things that are happening and different activities of different living beings. They have no idea how many living beings there are on this one planet. You can't count them. So how will they understand, you know, the Lord's activities of creating millions of universes? Not just one, but millions of universes. It's hopeless. Prabhupada gave the example of a bull that's tied to a stake. Because we were having discussions with him when the fifth canto came out. That gives some description of the cosmos. And the devotees had attempted to make a drawing of taken from the descriptions, and they put those drawings in the front of the first edition of the fifth canto. Then some other devotees protested that actually these drawings are not correct and they shouldn't be put in. And I remember Hari Kesh having a long discussion with Srila Prabhupada in Mayapur about, you know, the fifth canto cosmology, because at that time, of course, we were also, Prabhupada was talking about, you know, the Vedic planetarium in Mayapur, building a temple which would actually be a planetarium inside it and which would show practically the lower regions of this universe, the middle regions, the higher regions, then beyond that to Lord Shiva's abode, and then beyond that to Vaikuntha, and then beyond that to Goloka Vrindavan. So in this way, Prabhupada wanted dioramas, or by any means, technology, whatever is available, to show the Vedic view of the universe. So, of course, to be able to present that, you have to be able to at least understand, you know, some of it to some degree. And So there was a fair bit of confusion when the fifth canto first came out, the descriptions that were there. Some devotees were speculating, you know, that it's saying that the earth is actually flat, and then some of the people were saying, no, no, you know, it's actually like a curve. And then there were other descriptions, no, no, it's actually all the planets are little balls, as we understand them from material science. So nobody could really make head nor tail of it. It was very difficult. And, you know, the whole concept of the sun going around everything rather than everything going around the sun, and the pole star in the middle being the pivot and everything else is revolving, and then the sun's revolving around that. And, you know, the plane of Bhumandala and the descriptions, you know, of all the different areas of Bhumandal with the mountain ranges and, you know, the different oceans of oil and milk and so many things. So how to present that as a reality? Very difficult when we have such limited perceptions. And Prabhupada was, you know, giving some description. He was trying to explain to us. We were talking with him for more than an hour, and he was just trying to get us even to the simple, you know, first base of understanding. Just he pointed to the chandelier and he was explaining how all the planets are situated just like the lights on the chandelier, and they're all moving around like this. And it was just difficult for us to conceive of it. And, you know, we have this task of building this Vedic planetarium to show an alternative viewpoint to the world. The scientists have their view of the world, you know, that things come from bacteria or microbes or whatever it is, the original forms of life, they say. Some explosion was there and some interaction of chemicals. And then things have just kind of evolved from there. And they try to give some idea of, you know, the cosmology, you know, with their ideas of black holes and, you know, imploding stars and exploding stars and and so many things. But they can't actually come anywhere close to it. It's very difficult. So Prabhupada gave this example of the bull that's tied by a rope to a stake. And he's walking around and around in circles. And that's his whole universe. That's what he conceives. That's what he sees. And that's his whole life. And he can't see beyond that. But of course, beyond that, there's so many other things that are inconceivable to him. So in the similar way, you know, when we were trying to understand, well, Meru, it's such a huge mountain, where could it be? And if it's so big, why can't we see it? And so many things. So Prabhupada gave this example. He said, you are prejudiced, he said. Yeah, you have your own idea. And therefore, you find it difficult to accept the descriptions of the Bhagavatam. But this is your position. Walking around and around in a circle like this, like the cow tied to the stake. And thinking, no, I can see the whole world. Actually, we can't see anything. We have some conception of three dimensions. Yeah, but beyond that, there are many, many dimensions of existence that we can't perceive. Some of them we can half perceive, just like, you know, in so-called paranormal phenomena, ghosts and subtle beings. Sometimes they can make their influence felt, you know, on the physical plane, in the 3D dimensional plane. But ghosts, they're able to go straight through the walls. We cannot do that because we're limited by three dimensions. But they're not limited by three dimensions. They live in another dimension. But that isn't, you know, it's very close to our 3D world. So we get sometimes glimpses of this other dimension. And if you look, you know, at the composition of the universe, whatever we think, just like we think in terms of things being solid, but they're not solid. Nothing's solid. When you actually look down at the, you know, atomic level, nothing is actually solid. And there are certain things that can easily penetrate things that we think are solid, just like sound vibration, you know. It can go through so many different combinations of elements. So what we perceive as reality is not reality. That's the point. It's just, you know, whatever we have a capability to understand. And we live according to that. And then we create this illusion for ourselves of thinking this is all there is. And then when somebody gives a description of something else and says, no, there's so much beyond that, then we say, oh no, this can't be true. Yeah, because we can't perceive it. But the Bhagavatam challenges us to give up or go beyond, you know, our own perceptions and takes us into a realm of understanding which, you know, is just unlimited. It's so far above and beyond anything that we can perceive or understand with our own senses, minds, and intelligence. So people tend to think, oh, this is just mythology. But it's not mythology. It's just other levels of reality that we are not actually able to enter into or to perceive. But just because we can't do it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist, and we should never reject things, you know, just on the basis of our own understandings. So Prabhupada was always stressing this. I remember one time in Melbourne, we had one devotee. He was a little different from the rest of us, actually. He was he worked in a government office, suit and tie, you know, nice short cropped hair, black hair. All the rest of us in those days, this was like in 1972 in Sydney, in Australia. We were all just kids, you know, kind of few hippies here and there and, you know, backpackers and stragglers. And, you know, none of us had any real, fixed up position. Most of us were about 18 to 22 years old. But this one man, he used to come around and he worked in, you know, the government offices in the city. And he was a very, what we call a straight in those days. Means he was normal. And so he would come, and he would have, you know, bursts of enthusiasm. He would get all involved. At a certain point, he got initiated. He was given the name Raghunath. And then sometimes he would just disappear again, and we wouldn't see him for months on end. And then he would come back again. And he was always having problems, mental, because, you know, the descriptions of the Bhagavatam sometimes would overwhelm him, and we would just think this is too, you know, it's just too odd or too far out to be true. And I remember Prabhupada came in 75, he opened the Melbourne temple, and Raghunath was on, you know, one of his more enthusiastic periods. So he was coming and listening to Prabhupada's lectures, and then Prabhupada called for questions, and so then he asked Prabhupada, he said, how can we understand that, you know, there's this personality who has four heads and he flies around on a swan, you know, all over the universe? And he said, are we supposed to, you know, take that as literal, or is that like allegorical? Or, and then Prabhupada chastised him. He said, oh, you don't think that Lord Brahma can have, you know, more heads than you, or that, you know, why not a swan? He said, you're flying around on 747s, so why Lord Brahma can't fly around on a swan like this? And, you know, he was saying, don't try to reduce things down to your own perceptions. You know, there are many wonderful things that are way beyond what you can understand. It doesn't mean that they're not true. It doesn't mean that, you know, because you can't understand them or perceive them, that they're not true. There's so many things. What do you understand, actually? Nothing. You know, we have minuscule, you know, atomic realization and experience. Now, what can we know about millions of universes and beyond that, how they're created and maintained and annihilated? So we have to have a little shraddha, little faith, at least. At least we should have no faith in our own abilities and perceptions. That's the first thing. But we should have some faith that there are some personalities who actually know more than us. And then we should hear from them and we should try to understand, you know, what they're telling us. So Prabhupada was able to present amazing things to us, but in such a way that we could actually perceive these things to be true. That was Prabhupada's unique ability. I think Prabhupada was the first person that we ever met who actually was able to challenge material science. You know, we're brought up and educated in the school systems, and we're given right from our early age all this propaganda about evolution, you know, and the whole development of species and all these different things, you know, Charles Darwin. And we take that as being the absolute truth. You know, we're presented that by our teachers and parents and, you know, other authorities, the whole government, everything. You know, this is the view of the world that we're given. So Prabhupada, and you know, to say anything contrary to that is to be ridiculed. You know, people actually think, if you don't believe in evolution, they actually think you're a little crazy. You know, what? You know, you can't understand evolution. You don't believe in evolution. They just think you're a little nutty. But Prabhupada was able to come straight out, you know, and challenge it and say evolution is complete nonsense and give us an alternative, and a credible alternative also. I think Prabhupada was the first person that we met that was openly challenging like that. Because the Christians also, they have, you know, their own ideas about creation. But even the Catholic Church officially, you know, the Vatican, I think in the early 60s, they accepted evolutionary theory as fact. They don't challenge it. They still say that there's a God, but they accept evolution also. Prabhupada was very boldly stating there's no such thing as evolution. This is all nonsense. You know, life is original. Life is the basis on which matter develops. There is a development of matter, yeah, but life is not developing from matter. It's the other way around. The life comes from life. So that was Prabhupada's challenge. And he told our scientists to go all over the world and challenge on the basis of the Bhagavatam, you know, this false materialistic worldview. And I don't think that there was a single day that when I traveled with Prabhupada, it was about a year and a half, I don't think there was a single day when Prabhupada didn't say something, you know, to cut down the material scientist's position and to criticize them in some way or in another. It was his favorite topic. And therefore, he wanted a planetarium, Vedic planetarium, to be built in Mayapur. Because Mayapur is the center of Lord Chaitanya's movement. And, you know, if Mayapur is healthy, if the devotional activities there are healthy, then Prabhupada said that will infuse all the rest of the Krishna conscious centers all around the world. And he said that millions of people will come to Mayapur in the future. And he wanted this Vedic planetarium to be built there as inside the temple, to show the Vedic worldview, to challenge the scientists, and to expose their limitations and defects of their false philosophies, and to show a credible alternative. And Prabhupada said, scholars will come from all over the world to study what we present there. So the Bhagavatam is the basis for that. All the sufficient information is there to be able to challenge and defeat all the modern scientific theories, false theories about life coming from matter. So that's our task, that we have to read these things, we have to understand them nicely, and figure out the ways and means of presenting these in such a way that people will actually think, yes, actually there's some credibility to this. Prabhupada actually told our scientists, Sarup Damodar and Sataputta, these men, he said, if you can just prove one thing, just show one thing, that we're not this body. Yeah? It doesn't matter about anything else, you know, Goloka Vrindavan, Vaikuntha, other universes, just show this one thing, that life is different from matter, that we are not this body. He said, and then you have defeated them, finished. Then all their scientific theories are finished. Because that's the pivotal point. That's the whole basis on which their theories are built. You know, that life is just matter. And fundamentally, we say that, you know, that's wrong. If we can just show that one thing, then everything else will follow after that. So this is a big task. It's not easy going against, you know, the entire world. Everybody believes in evolution. Yeah. But just recently, of course, there's been some challenges in the courts in America where they want to now introduce this idea of intelligent design. It's interesting because they're not presenting it as a theological understanding. Intelligent design just means admitting that combinations of chemicals have not been observed to give a rise to life. That evolution has never been actually proved, and there are so many anomalies with it to disprove it. And at the same time, life itself, living mechanisms, organisms, is so complex that you cannot explain how they're coming into existence by mechanical means. And there's many, many different examples that they give, of course. There's one book, actually, that Torchlight Publishing, that's run by our devotee, Advaita Chandra Prabhu. There's some devotees in Hungary. They put together a book, again, challenging evolution. And they give many examples of different animals where their behavior is so different from the norm, if you like, that you cannot actually explain it by evolution. Evolution means that in small, small increments, things gradually change from one thing to another. Because the defect is that there's no interims. We see all the different species of life, and we don't see the interim stages, you know, to bring, say, like a monkey to a man. You've got monkeys, they're there, and we've got men, and they're also there simultaneously. Where are the interim stages? And they're always looking for these links. They've not found them. And there's different kinds of animals that have such unusual abilities that there's no way that you can explain how they got to be like that, you know, in these incremental development stages by evolution. There's one kind of fish, and the way it eats is it kind of glides just under the surface of the water, and then when it sees a fly in the air, it pops up and spits at it, and then the fly falls down and then it in the water, and then it eats it like this. So it has this is how it eats. It spits. So how did it get that ability by evolution? No other fish have it. And every fish that it gives birth to, that fish, has the same ability. They all spit. You know, it's the spitting species of fish. So how is it this one fish is there? How did that first fish that spits, how did that evolve? And how is it that now it's producing so many other fish that have exactly the same ability? You can't explain that by evolution. It's ridiculous. Yeah, and there's so many different examples. There's examples just like Bhaktisri Rupa Damodar used to give this example of the crocodile. Because when crocodiles, they lay eggs. So first of all, they lay their eggs on the banks of the river and they cover them. And then they leave them for some months, you know, to kind of hibernate. What do you call it? Not hibernate. Incubate. To incubate. Then at a certain point, the female crocodile comes back and she digs them up. Then one egg at a time, she takes them in her mouth and she swims out into the water. And then she holds her mouth open and keeps it open. And then she has the egg underneath her tongue and she starts rolling it backwards and forwards. And then gradually, the little crocodile inside, then, you know, the shell, he starts to hatch out from this motion of the mother and the heat from the mouth. So then the eggshell, the egg breaks, the little crocodile comes out, he jumps out his mother's mouth, she's still got it holding her jaws open, and then it swims back to shore. So this, I mean, you know, crocodiles are ferocious. You know, they use the word prehistoric. They look like some kind of prehistoric monster, the way that they're, you know, they're scaly and fangs and they're ferocious. We had a devotee in Australia. Her father was a crocodile hunter, and he had hunted crocodiles in New Guinea for about 18 years. Then he retired, and he started a crocodile farm on a small island called Green Island, which is on the Great Barrier Reef in the north of Australia. So we went there to visit him. They have some little visitor's chalets, and he has this crocodile farm. So he's got all these big pens with the, and he has the biggest crocodile in captivity. I think it was 24 feet long, you know, from the tip of its nose to the tip of its tail. Huge thing. I mean, unbelievable. So he's got this huge crocodile, and of course he has to feed them every day. So he was telling us one time he has like a raised, like a stage that he goes into, and there's a trap door. And he opens up the trap door and he drops all the food down through the trap door, and the crocodiles come and they take it away and eat it. So this one day he said he went and he opened up the trap door and he reached down. Usually says he watches to see where all the crocodiles are. And when you see crocodiles, sometimes they can just sit there for days and not move. They seem to be like really lazy, you know, really mode of ignorance kind of animals, and they'll just sit there and not even move. They'll hardly blink their eyelids for hours and hours or even days on end. So he would watch and see where the crocodiles are before he went in to feed them so that he knew where they all were. And this particular day, the big crocodile wasn't around, so he was a little cautious. He opens up the trap door, and he reached down to get something from underneath. And then all of a sudden he realized he had to pull his hand out. He pulled his arm out and the jaws of this crocodile just kind of clumped shut just like an inch from him. Just missed him. He was waiting for him. But they're really fast, crocodiles. And they can jump up in the air to get prey. They can jump up, you know, like practically the length of their bodies. So many yards up into the air. They're really fast when they want to get something. And they can swim really fast. So they're ferocious beings. You know, just these huge jaws that cramp down on their prey, and that's it, you're finished. So this big ferocious, they're like killing machines. But yet, the mother very tenderly rolls the egg underneath the tongue, back and forth. The little baby comes out. She doesn't eat her own children. She lets them jump out and swim back to shore, and they look after them and bring them up. So how by evolution, you know, as this so-called primitive prehistoric animal learnt this sense, you know, of looking after the young, taking out the eggs, hatching them out very carefully. How by mechanical processes can this occur? It's ludicrous to suggest such a thing. That we're just, you know, a series of pushes and pulls of different chemicals interacting with each other. And we had another example with Prabhupada when we were in Bhubaneswar in 1977. And Prabhupada had gone there to do the foundation stone for the temple there. So the devotees were taking him out to different places for his morning walk. So one morning we went out, there's a zoo just nearby, famous zoo. So we went there. It was before opening time, but the zookeepers, they allowed us to walk around. So we got to the lion cages, and there was like a double cage. On one side, there was one big male, and then on the other side, there was a whole family. There was a male and a couple of females and some cubs. So they're kind of sitting there very, you know, very depressing, actually, to see them. Prabhupada didn't like the zoo because all the animals were locked up and not allowed to, you know, have their natural habitat and roam around freely. And especially, he didn't like seeing the lions trapped in these tiny little cages. So anyway, we stopped in front of the cages. We were looking at them. And as we were looking, then the zookeeper came, and he had a goat that he'd just killed fresh goat meat, like a whole carcass of a goat. And he opened the door and threw the carcass in. And then, you know, the lions had been just sitting there kind of really, you know, dopey and depressed. And then as soon as the meat came in, of course, they jumped up and went over, and then they started tearing apart this carcass. So first of all, the male, you know, he goes up and he gets his share, and then the females, and then the cubs. And Prabhupada was watching this, so he said, just see. He said, they're hungry, they want to eat. But he said that the male lion, he's so powerful, he could easily kill the cubs and eat them. If he's hungry, why not do that? But no, he doesn't. He's sitting there very, you know, nicely with his family. There's some sense there that this is family. So, you know, you don't eat them. They eat the goat, but he won't eat his own cubs. So he said, this is, you know, proof of the existence of the soul, because there's that intelligence, you know, there's that emotional involvement. Even amongst the lower animals, they have some sense or some sentiment that this is children, this is wife, you know, we have to look after them. So otherwise, you know, a lion, they're just, you know, again, they're ferocious animals. Another interesting thing that happened was whilst we were watching that, Guru Kripa was there. And he was standing on the other cage where the single lion was there. And that lion was just there. It was kind of half asleep. And he was trying to provoke it. He wanted to make it roar. He wanted to hear the lion roar. So he was, you know, trying to agitate it. And initially, it wasn't paying any attention because, you know, they get bored. They're there every day, all day. They see these human beings coming in front of them. They just ignore them. They get very bored. So anyway, Guru Kripa was determined that he was going to make this lion roar. So somehow or another, he managed to agitate it sufficiently that it gave a little roar, like this. And we all looked, and Prabhupada looked. And then Prabhupada chastised Guru Kripa. He said, don't do that. He said, after all, he is a lion. Means give him some respect. He's a powerful animal. He's the king of the jungle. Just because now he's locked up in a cage, you know, you would never do that if you were with him in the jungle. Right? Agitate him like that. But because he's locked up, now you want to take advantage. That's disrespectful. So Prabhupada had this nice respect for other living beings. And he was making the point that they also have their own respect within their own clan. So anyway, he used that as, you know, a good example that if evolution is just, you know, this chemical interaction, pushes and pulls, then such a ferocious beast, it would eat anything in its path. But it doesn't. It doesn't eat its own. Now, anyway, there's many, many such examples. And these things, so these devotees in Hungary, they've compiled a lot of stuff like this. And they're going to put this book out. Again, as part of this challenge against material scientific understandings. And as I say, in America, they have this challenge in the courts going on now that it should not be that in the schools that they teach that evolution is a fact. They should at least be able to put a disclaimer that this is just a theory. That's all. That we're going to teach you a theory. This is one idea. And they want the right to be able to teach an alternative theory of an intelligent design and show how living organisms are so complex that evolutionary theory cannot account for them. And that then that leaves the possibility of an alternative explanation. That's all they want to do. They don't want to come right out and say, you know, there's a God and God created everything. So intelligent design, that's all. No mention of God, but just simply things are so complex that they've been designed. They couldn't have come about simply by chance. Because if things were happening by chance, then you'd get all kinds of anomalies in the formations of bodies. Prabhupada used to give this example. He would point to a daffodil or a marigold, and he would say, why from this seed, always, you get exactly the same flower? Yeah, same formation, same colors, same scent. If everything's just happening by chance, that means at any moment, you know, the combinations can change. And then, you know, why not, you know, a marigold that smells like a banana or, you know, whatever. But no, consistently, they're all producing the same kinds of things again and again and again. So these are simple things, but they have a very, very profound meaning, or that they have a very profound implication. Yeah, just a simple thing like that, that observation. Prabhupada said, I'm not a scientist, but he said, and nor have I been trained in science, but he said, but I can challenge any scientist on the basis of what's in the Bhagavatam. And Prabhupada did that. As he traveled around the world, sometimes the devotees would bring to him all different kinds of, you know, scholars, professors, scientists, politicians. And Prabhupada was able to, you know, defeat them. Whenever they presented some idea, Prabhupada was able to immediately go beyond their perceptions and show the limitations to what they were saying and present to them a broader scope of understanding. And nobody could actually defeat Srila Prabhupada. I saw that. I never saw Prabhupada in a position where he couldn't answer somebody's question, you know, or he didn't have an explanation for something that somebody was, you know, challenging him on. He was expert because he knew the Bhagavatam. So anyway, if we keep pushing like this, we want to try to present what's in the Bhagavatam, this vision of multiple universes and creation and maintenance and annihilation by a supreme being. You know, it's not so fantastic, you know, that the Lord can take the form of a snake, multi-headed snake. I mean, if you tell an ordinary person, you know, that no, actually all the universes are resting on the heads of a multi-headed snake and he's bobbing up and down, they'll think you're crackers. They don't think that you're crackers if you say that originally there was this bacteria, and then from bacteria now we have human beings. Yeah, how ridiculous is that? They think that we're ridiculous because we say, no, Lord Brahma has four heads and he flies around on a swan, or Anantashesha is a snake, this gigantic snake, and he has universes resting on his hoods. They think that's ridiculous, but they don't think it's ridiculous to say that from a bacteria, which has no sensual attributes, it doesn't have any eyes, ears, nose, skin, you know, bones, blood, lungs, kidneys, livers, nothing. You won't find anything in a bacteria. But somehow or another, they're trying to tell us that from that bacteria, then this very complex, you know, human body or insect body or bird body or fish, all of that's come from bacteria. I mean, how ridiculous is that? And they actually do this. There's a program that was shown a few years ago on British TV, made by the BBC, called The Human Body. And they filmed, you know, the so-called evolution of the human body from the point of conception. They actually filmed, you know, the semen of the father meeting up the little gametes or whatever they call them, that are in the semen of the father, meeting up with the egg of the mother, penetrating the egg, and then the egg being fertilized, and then immediately beginning to multiply. From one egg it becomes two, from two it becomes four, from four it becomes eight, eight becomes 16, and in this way, over a period of a few weeks, then a body starts to develop. And they actually filmed it right from the very beginning, at the point of conception, all the way through the different stages, the 9 months in the womb of the mother, then the birth, and then how the body develops over a lifetime in childhood, and all the different physical and mental changes that are going on, and then in adolescence. So like this, it's an amazing thing, actually, when you see this, and you see how complex the body is and how it develops. It's just unbelievable. It's incredible. So they wanted to show that, but they begin the program with this man who's the like the MC, the compere. He's a doctor. He's standing in Yellowstone National Park, or one of those places in America, and there's all mud, and there's hot water bubbling up from underneath the mud flats. And then he points down, and he said, "This is the beginning of life." He said, "Here there's bacteria, and from this bacteria, all the things that we see have developed by evolution." It's just, I mean, you know, it's outrageous. You ask them, all right, you show us how a bacteria is becoming, you know, an eagle. Or how is a bacteria becoming a human being or a crocodile? Or that, no explanation. No, it's just somehow or another over millions of years. We can't understand how. It's too much for us to perceive, but we know it happened. Right? So it's the same thing that they accuse the religionists of, that they have to have a little faith. So because we observe things, you know, then we know it happens somehow or another. Now we have to, even if we can't explain it, we should accept it as an axiomatic truth. This is the position that the material scientists have got to, because they can't prove evolution. They can't substantiate the claim. But they say, oh no, we have so many overwhelming evidences. Although they can't actually show life coming from matter. So they say we should just accept that it's axiomatic. You don't have to prove it. It's so obvious. But if a religionist says the same thing, that things are so intricately designed, they're so amazing in their construction, that it can't possibly have come about by chance, and that therefore the existence of these living organisms must come by design, and design implies intelligence. And intelligence means, right, it means personality. So we say, you accept that as axiomatic, that life is original. This is your beginning point for understanding what everything is around you. They say, no, this is just some religious mumbo jumbo. Yeah. That this is just some faith. And we can't have faith in the schools. We only want science in the schools. So this is the way that they're, you know, trying to counter the attempt now to have this intelligent design at least, you know, accept it as an alternative theory in the school system. They say, no, this is just faith, and science is reality. Science is real knowledge, and that's what we want in our schools. But when you look at what they're presenting as science, it's not science. It's not science at all. It's just they have faith in some idea that they've got, but no proof. And they want to criticize us for having faith in God, or having faith in the Bhagavatam. So these things we can challenge. Prabhupada challenged them. He knew he could immediately find out the flaws in these materialistic scientific, so-called scientific theories. And he could present an alternative science, the science of Bhakti Yoga, the science of Godhead, the science of the Srimad Bhagavatam. It's just as valid. It's not unscientific. It's just as valid as any other science. So we have to learn how to become expert in exposing the flaws of the material scientists and in presenting what's in the Srimad Bhagavatam as a credible alternative. And that was Prabhupada's purpose for building the planetarium in Mayapur, to show the Vedic view of the world. Yeah. As an credible alternative. So we have a lot of work to do, but it can be done. And there'll be a point at which, you know, the challenge will become so strong it will be irresistible. Right now it seems like we're in a minority. You know, every school in the world, every culture in the world teaches evolution as a fact. But somehow or another we have to turn that tide. And it can be done. Everything starts off very small, becomes very big. If there's some truth to it, then it will become, you know, accepted eventually. So this is one of our purposes, to challenge material science and defeat it. If we can just show that one thing, yeah, that life does not come from matter, then they're finished. Okay, it's getting a bit late. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Do we have any scientists here? I mean material scientists. We have spiritual scientists. I once had an experience when I was giving a Sunday feast lecture in Brisbane a few years back. And I was speaking about how they never went to the moon. This is also one of the controversial things. Even nowadays, I see some of our own devotees are embarrassed to speak about, you know, how they never went to the moon. They don't feel confident to support Prabhupada's statements. But anyway, I was giving this lecture on the Sunday feast, and I was telling people, you know, I brought this thing up about, you know, how scientists claim that they went to the moon, but actually they never went, and the whole thing is bogus. So at the end of it, there were a couple of people there. They were actually school teachers, and one of them was a science teacher in a high school. So they said, how can you say that, you know, we never went to the moon? So I just repeated what Prabhupada used to repeat, you know, that ultimately things get down to which authority you accept. In science, it's well known that very little is known about two things: origins of species and the cosmology of the universe. These two areas, they have very, very vague information. So I just explained that, you know, scientists claim one thing, the Bhagavatam claims another. And ultimately, it gets down to which authority that you accept, because you have not been to the moon. Now, I haven't been to the moon. And according to the Bhagavatam, the moon is a heavenly planet. You know, and there are living beings there. They live in, you know, other dimensions. But this is a heavenly planet. It's not dust and rocks. And when you see what you think is the moon, you're not actually seeing the moon. And nor do you have the technology to go there anyway. So I gave this whole explanation. And by the end of it, then they sat back and they said, actually, what you said is a fact. We actually don't really know. You know, we're just taking it on faith. And they accepted that, yes, your alternative explanation could be just as feasible. So this was a science teacher, and I don't know anything about science, but I just repeated what I'd heard Srila Prabhupada say, you know, all the different points that he made about the moon being a heavenly planet and its effect, you know, on this planet, the cooling rays, how it, you know, agitates the vegetables to grow, and so many different things. So how can it be just dust and rocks? So we can challenge them. But Prabhupada said, if you want to challenge, you have to know what you're talking about. There was Alanath, I think, when we were on a morning walk in December of 75 in Vrindavan. And again, Prabhupada was talking about, you know, science, and he was challenging, you know, that you produce life. If, you know, we give you the ingredients, just like a chicken can make an egg, and from that egg, then life comes within a few days. So I said, now if we give you some yellow substance and some white substance, and with plastic you can make a shell, you know, you gather up the ingredients and make an egg, and then from that produce a chicken. Can you do it? And of course, no. Then Prabhupada said, then the chicken is a better scientist than you. So you should give your Nobel Prize to the chicken. So like that, Prabhupada was talking. So this boy, Alanath, he said, well, actually, we're going to produce a magazine in Sweden challenging the scientists. So he, you know, he thought that Prabhupada would be immediately, you know, approving and encouraging about that. But Prabhupada stopped and he said, don't do it unless you are expert. He said, I can challenge because I am confident. I know, you know, what's in the Bhagavatam. But he said, unless you know these things, he said, you cannot challenge, then it will look foolish. So you have to develop the expertise to be able to challenge these rascals and destroy this false understanding that their whole world currently is being suppressed by, actually, because it's ignorance being presented as knowledge. And therefore, the real purpose of life is being spoiled. People don't know what the purpose of life is. Because as soon as you accept that chance is, you know, the alternative to God, then there's no purpose to life. Everything happens by chance. So you have this one lifetime, do as you like, do anything you like, just at any cost, enjoy your senses and your mind, and then that's it, nothing. This is where all this immorality, all this, you know, offensive activity that's going on nowadays, it all comes from this philosophy of evolution. As soon as you accept that there's a God, that means that you have to find out now, that means there's a purpose. It means you have a relationship. That means that there's a superior sentient force that is overseeing all your activities. And that means that if you do something offensive or wrong, you are liable to punishment. That's the implication. That means immediately everybody has to behave. Yeah? You have to be a little respectful to other people. There's morality. This is what morality is. But as soon as you say everything happens by chance, immediately, oh, no need for morality. It's just whatever's convenient, that's all, to serve the purposes of fulfilling the sensual desires. So the breakdown of human society, all the higher standards of behavior and activity, all comes from this evolutionary theory. It's destroying human society, actually, and returning us back to an animalistic condition. So we have to destroy this evolutionary idea, this scientific idea. All right, we're going to finish there. It's very late. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Are we speaking tonight? We are. What time? No, you tell me what time. But I have to leave very, very early. Yeah, how will you let everybody else know? Hare Krishna. All right. But if my flight's at 5:30, that means I'll have to be at the airport latest by 4 o'clock. So at that time in the morning, how long does it take to get?
20 minutes.
Okay. So then if I leave at 3 o'clock, I'll be there 2 hours before. So then that means I have to get up at about 2:30 at the latest. So I need to get to bed early. Yeah. 8 to 2. So if there's a program, it should be like from 6 to 7:30 or something like that.